The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
LinkedIn presents.
Hello and welcome to the Big Technology Podcast, a show for cool-headed, nuanced conversation of the tech world and beyond. Well, if the market has a cold, then fintech or financial technology has the flu. Every company from SoFi to PayPal, Square, you name it, Robinhood, which has been in the headlines this week, seems like it's been a disaster for all of them. I think that we've been long overdue on the show to have a deep discussion of what's going on in the financial technology world. And especially now that these companies that have enabled what was supposed to be a democratic revolution in the finance world, many of those dreams haven't come to fruition, at least yet. It's time for us to dig in and figure out what's going on. We couldn't have a better guest to do it with us today than Dan Dolev, who is the managing director and senior analyst at Mizuho. He is a great analyst. He's on CNBC all the time, covers companies like Dan, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but Robinhood, Affirm, SoFi, Coinbase, you name it. We're about to get into that and more. Dan, welcome to the show.
Hey, Alex. Pleasure to be here. I'm glad we solved all the tech issues, and it's a big honor to be on your podcast.
Well, it's great to have you here. And yes, tech issues, we get those every week. So the true the hero behind the scenes is Nate Gwatney, who manages to turn these around quickly. So we usually thank Nate at the end, but the man is a saint.
I can tell you, your technology is better than the Square analyst day. Technology was awful. Okay. So you've already won on that.
Low bar to clear. So we're going to talk about financial technology. I think, you know, sometimes with these discussions, it's always a given. Okay, of course, there is an area called fintech. There's an area called biotech. Financial technology is interesting because we have like a pretty well-established banking system with certain safeguards for people. And most people don't, well, maybe I'm being getting ahead of myself. Most people don't seem to have problems with their banks. Generally, the bigger system they do, but the banks, I don't hear too many complaints about them. You can help me shoot down those, you know, that assertion if you'd like. So I just want to start with this very basic fundamental question, which is, financial technology, why does it exist? What is it trying to do? Is it trying to replace banks, disrupt certain things within banks? Why do we have a fintech industry, and what's the opportunity?
Look, this is like an excellent question. And I would say there's different answers to that question, right? Thinking through what you're saying, I think, you know, the gospel here, you know, if you're really into this, is basically there's a big group of people out there that are not well served by the banks, right? Like, we are all like sort of, you know, we have, you know, great lives and, very cushy jobs and we're all doing really well. But there's a lot of people, you know, in America, but also globally, like that are underbanked or unbanked. I think in America, there's like 40, 50, 60 million people who are either underbanked or unbanked, i.e. they're not either they have a bank account, but that bank doesn't give them anything. It doesn't give them credit. It doesn't give them any services that, you know, like that they need. And the fintech industry sort of emerged out of the need of those people. This is kind of the grassroots movement. It emerged out of the need of those people to actually have more access to the financial ecosystem. So initially it was these, you know, the Western unions of the world, et cetera, and the cash checked. And that morphed into sort of more with technology, it morphed into more complicated and complex apps like the Cash App on the one hand, the Buy Now, Pay Later firm on the other hand, and sort of all this neobank era of like the Chimes, et cetera, of the world. So I think that was the need that created the fintech industry. And I really think that's kind of probably the biggest sort of driver, the biggest moat to the industry, is like servicing the unbanked and underbanked. To your point,
right?
Banks are doing fine. Most people don't need fintech.
And so, how does that Well, first of all, I would say that anything is an improvement over Western Union. If you've ever tried to send money through Western Union, it is a disaster, and anything is an improvement over there. That's why when I was in El Salvador, and I know I like to talk about this a lot on the show, and I saw people, you know, adopting Bitcoin. It's now legal tender there. You know, I thought not, hey, this government should invest in these in Bitcoin, you know, through the treasury, but this actually might help, you know, above all remittances. So when you talk about the promise of fintech, that definitely makes a lot of sense, and it resonates that there's folks that are underserved by the banking system. I recant my opening statement. That being said, what is the opportunity then? Because if it's mostly going to the unbanked folks, you know, we're just coming through a moment of sky high valuations for these fintech companies. Now they're on the other side of that. So how do you think about the opportunity in fintech? If basically, you know, a lot of tech is, you know, let's disrupt what's in, what's, you know, the current leader. But from my understanding, you know, listening to you, it's not let's disrupt the JP Morgan. It's, you know, let's fill in the gaps that they're missing. And if that's the case, what's the opportunity? Because you look at some of the valuations of some of these companies, and, you know, they're way higher than you would imagine if the opportunity is simply just to fill in the gaps of the mainstream banking system.
Right. And I would say that the what we're seeing right now, the dislocation in the market that we're seeing right now is a function of, I would say, at least two forces that are working together. One, as we all know, COVID is a round trip. Mm-hmm. Everything that went up went down. And fintech, particularly payments and fintech, is a leading indicator. So you're seeing basically payments and fintech peaking. I call this FIFO, first in, first out. Payment has peaked fastest before COVID. So i.e. in like the second quarter of 2020, basically everyone was like piling into payments. It's had an amazing 12-month run. And then it was the first one to start kind of like the broken story started with multiples for the payments ecosystem. And now it's down. I think the bigger picture is it's almost like, you know, why is payments so bad right now? And the reason, the answer is just, it's too good and everyone wants a piece of it. And I think that's what's happening. So if you think about, like, if you kind of parse out the, so like, if you think about, say, let's think about PayPal. Let me give you some specific examples, right? So
wait, but before we go in, I just want to, again, like, let's zoom out before we go into like why the stock has fallen and, you know, risen. Like, if you think about a JP Morgan, their market cap is $340 billion. You know, when we look at like some of these other companies, I had a bunch of them open earlier. But you know, they were like, basically some of them were like half of that. You know, we had a firm, for instance, I don't know if they were that high, but you know, you look at it like, I don't know, a couple of years ago,
40, 50 billion.
So we're talking about, this isn't exactly, you know, supplementing the banking industry. It's replacing in some ways. So do you think the valuations really never reflected what the opportunity was? B, maybe the opportunity is bigger than you led on originally, or something in between?
I think the opportunity for certain names in certain areas is probably mm-hmm. bigger than we think. Like, honestly think, like you mentioned, Affirm. I think Affirm could be the Visa and MasterCard of buy now, pay later.
Right. And shout out what Affirm does and explain why that's the case.
That's actually interesting. So Affirm is like the market leader in the US in buy now, pay later, right? So everybody knows buy now, pay later. Like, think of it as instead of pay as you go, owe as you go.
Or, right.
You know, kind of like credit as you go.
Yeah. And Apple's getting into that area now also. So.
Okay. So if you think, let's go back to this. So if you think about Affirm, right? Instead of like kind of like buy now, pay later, think of it as like credit as you go. So the traditional credit card system is basically you get a FICO score, you get a credit card or you get several credit cards, and then you have like a huge APR, you owe a lot of interest, a lot of people are like kind of in debt. And what buy now, pay later offers in a firm is like the front runner in the US is basically like the ability to get credit on a product by product basis. And why is that so powerful? Again, there is a certain group, there's a certain demographic, a certain socioeconomic group that is, you know, in, you know, doesn't want to have credit cards. They don't trust credit cards, right? Especially younger people. And they prefer to buy things and finance them. It's basically a cash flow management tool, finance them on a, you know, step-by-step basis. And, you know, Affirm has built a brand that basically is a big lure to a lot of people. So when they want to buy sneakers, when they want to buy something on Amazon, they check out using Affirm and they finance, say, and pay in four, et cetera. So that's essentially what they do. It's really not that complicated of a business, but it's become a big, they're answering a big demand trend and they're there to service it.
So we're going to get into every company as we go along on this show. But I just want to ask you another broad question. You know, I like tackling these broad ones in the beginning. You have, okay, so first of all, Affirm, buy now, pay later. I don't know. Let me ask this quick one and then we get to the bigger one. How does that impact people's credit scores? So when I, you know, opened a bank account and went in to deposit a check when I was like 18, the banker, you know, pulled me aside and it's like, you should open a credit card because you want to build credit. Can you build credit in the same way through a company like Affirm and never having a credit card open?
Yeah, so you actually, that's the interesting point. You don't actually build credit. You basically build credit on Affirm.
Right. But like your credit score, it's not going to help you build your credit score.
It's not going to help you, but it's not going to hurt you if you default. That's
interesting.
Again, remember, there's a lot of people. I think what we're dealing with here is like a new generation, like Gen Z, that prefers, it's like they prefer to share a car than to own a car. They prefer to, it's basically taking credit and turning it into as borrow as you go.
But eventually they're going to want to buy a house, and having a high credit score is important for that. So doesn't this hurt them in the long run?
If they don't do anything else that helps them get a high FICO score, it's going to be a problem in the long run. I agree with you. So there, it has to be. I think, you know, the question that you're asking basically is this completely substituting credit or is this complementary to credit? I think right now they can like live side by side. So you're not doing everything on buy now, pay later. You're doing some things on buy now, pay later and some things on credit. But, you know, I think what eventually you'll see, Alex, is that you'll see regulators come in, and there's already like voices in DC. Remember, like Elizabeth Warren's of the world, actually Elizabeth Warren, they sent a letter to the CFPB to regulate buy now pay later. So I think eventually, which is a good thing, you will get more regulation around buy now pay later in Affirm, and which also means that you will get a FICO score.
Right. Yeah, that is a good thing. And this is kind of the worry that I have when I hear about like the way that all these fintech companies are operating. And I just want to state for the record that I believe in free choice. People should have, you know, if people make choices, you know, they should have those options. And I really don't like the whole idea of like gatekeepers saying like these options shouldn't be available because, you know, they could hurt people. Like let people make decisions on their own versus like have like, you know, obviously like I think the government should help protect people with some regulations, but like, you know, taking options away to me is, you know, is ridiculous. However, I think about the way that these companies work and the incentives they bring to bear. And I wonder if the fintech industry is going to go after the folks that don't have bank accounts or are underserved by the current banking system, how do we make sure, and this is like kind of different from, you know, the typical conversation, I think, but like about valuations and all that, but how do we make sure that they don't end up getting, you know, attracting customers, you know, from folks that are underserved from the banking system and exploiting them? For instance, you know, we look at Robinhood's, the way that they do business in this payment for order flow, which it says, okay, you know, the trades are free, but meanwhile, like you have the middlemen that are making a lot of money off of it. You have, you know, Affirm, which says buy now, pay later, you know, meanwhile, folks aren't building credit score. You have Coinbase that says, you know, go ahead and buy all these, you know, shit coins, you know, even with a manual to say, this is how you buy a coin or an index called bullshit, which by the way, happens to be down 99%, or something like that over the past little while.
It's going to go down to zero.
Yeah. It will go down to zero. Well, that's amazing. Yeah. And so I guess the broader question is how should we be celebrating fintech or should we be skeptical of fintech? I'm sure there must be some good in there, but I'm kind of curious. You look at these companies all the time. So are they helping people who are underserved or are they exploiting them?
They help them by exploiting them.
Okay, that's interesting. Can you say more about that?
Let me give you an example. Like I love examples because that's just being concrete. Yeah. Let's think about the Cash App. Mm-hmm. Best example of serving the underserved, right?
Why is that?
Sort of. Well, because the demographic of the Cash App. So in America, there's like two different P2P solutions, right? There's Venmo, which is mostly like, pampered millennials, East Coast and West Coast. Mm-hmm. And there's like Cash App, which is a lot Southeast, lower income demographics, kind of like minorities. Like it's sort of become a thing, right? Mm-hmm. It's in rap songs, right? It's become a thing. So, again, I'm not saying they're not exploiting that, but why are they doing it? Because they can. So how do they make money? Let's go back and think of how they make money, right? Because that's at the end of the day. So, about 45% of the Cash App revenue, which is gross profit and revenue is kind of what, synonymous for them, is from instant deposit. What is instant deposit? A lot of people don't know that. They charge you 175 basis points, which is 1.75%, to transfer money instantly to your bank account. Or you could do it for free if you wait 2 to 3 days. Mm-hmm. Now, who has the need to transfer money instantly to their bank account? I'm not being kind of cocky or anything, but I don't. Mm-hmm. I can wait 2-3 days. But there are some people out there, especially the people that use the Cash App, who cannot wait 2-3 days. They got to pay rent. They got to pay, someone. They got to send money home. They are the 99%.
Right. Right.
And they're taking 1% from the 99%, but they're almost taking close to 2% from the 98%. Whatever. Yeah. That pun is over because they raise prices. So it's not exploiting, but they're doing it because they can, because the end market, those users really need that service. So what they would argue, and I think there's a lot of to be on their defense right now, what they would argue is we're providing a service to a certain demographic that in the old days, you mentioned like the Western Unions, et cetera. I don't know Western Union very well, but we're providing a service that the cost of this money in the cash checked kind of like environment and like the old way, like the 10 years ago, was much more expensive. So the opportunity cost is higher. The APR that you pay for money is higher. And they say like, look, we're providing a service. We're democratizing this. I mean, to me, there's a finite kind of time horizon on this instant depositing, but that's just one example of how you can, let's not exploit, that's a bad word, but take advantage of a need of a certain demographic, for money because they don't have other options. And that's just one example of maybe helping and hurting at the same time.
Yeah, that's interesting. So basically, in other words, it sounds like what's happening is the old system was so bad that you could still come in and take some margin, but you're still going to be less exploitative than the old system because the old system was that bad.
Exactly. You're better. You're better than the way it used to be done. You're more efficient,
right?
But you're still probably overcharging for something that should be free.
So tech does, which makes tech so interesting, is it applies values at scale. It allows actions to be taken at scale. This is kind of old hat at this point, but something like a Robinhood or a Coinbase. I'm actually kind of curious. Now we have a little bit of vision in retrospect. Back in the meme stock days and the GameStop days, which we talked a lot about on this podcast, there was an idea that, people on, retail traders are turning the tables on the old institutions by using new tools. And, there was worry like, okay, maybe we did need some of those speed bumps. But now they've gone in and they you know, many people invested a lot in individual stocks and meme stocks. They invested a lot, not just in Bitcoin, but in various cryptocurrencies that have since, you know, taken a hit. And we're now in a moment where a lot of these stocks are way down. And a lot of these cryptocurrencies are way down. So, you know, let's take a look, you know, over the past year where there was initially this like, oh, these are empowering tools, but now a lot of people are paying for the party, right? So, ultimately, do you think this is a good thing or a bad thing that these tools had democratized so much access to investing?
I would bifurcate. I think between those two names that you mentioned, I think Robinhood is a good thing and Coinbase is a bad thing.
Okay. Why is that?
Well, let's talk about the good thing first. Like why do I think Robinhood is created value? Because they basically came to a new demographic, a new age group, right? Teenagers, younger people, and basically said, hey, we're going to create, investing is really complicated. Investing is really, you know, kind of opaque and sort of old school. Let's come in with innovation, with an amazing interface and, you know, give you free trading, right? And basically become your, you know, a funnel to have you as the, sort of as a, you buy, you know, the customer acquisition is, you know, the value proposition is come in when you're very young and then just basically grow with you over time. What did they do that's really good? They lowered trading fees to zero across the entire industry, single-handedly. Schwab, TD, they all had to follow suit and basically cut fees because of Robinhood. So what did they do? They helped democratize. I sort of hate that term because that's, you know, everyone's trying to democratize something. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yes, I do.
So it's sort of like, it's almost like a cliche, but think about Robinhood. The effect of Robinhood was to lower or bring trading fees literally to zero. Now there's a debate on PFOF, et cetera. We can talk about that too, but like they single-handedly, you know, disrupted the industry. So I think they did more good than bad.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Coinbase, on the other hand, basically
Robinhood. Before we go to Coinbase, Robinhood also sort of gamified the day trading thing. You even mentioned recently, I think this was probably you, that it's the most engaged audience, 6 to 7 yes. transactions per week. We know that right. like 90% of day traders lose. So I get bringing down the fee, but like, I don't want to say the speed bump was good because let people make their own decisions. But when you build this addictive product that, you know, people want to trade like crazy and we, you know, it's all good when everything goes up, but now everything has come down. Is it just, you know, an easy vehicle for people to learn hard lessons or where do you sort of stand on that front?
Mm. I'd rather they learn the hard lesson with small amounts.
Mm-hmm.
Then make even more irrational decisions down the road. Like if anyone is sort of, you know, put their life savings into AMC,
sorry,
and lost it all, you know, or mm-hmm. or one of these meme stocks, I think that the question is like how many of them have basically lost. I think look, there's a moral, deeper moral decision to everything, and especially when it comes to money and investing. And then the balance is, to your point, have they done more good or bad
mm-hmm.
to humanity or to the economy? I think if I had to do a verdict, I think they've done more good. But
yeah,
it's an open debate. I agree. Like the meme stock era is a
we can finally look back at it.
It's a mutation, right? It's a mutation. Of, so you could say they gamified it, but really what gamified it was the people that were using it, right? It's kind of, it's almost like the.
Oh, that's, know, well, it's designed that way though.
It's designed. Yeah. There's a casino kind of element
right.
to this, but you know, it's not just them. That's what I'm saying. Like yeah. it's everyone. They probably took it to the umpteenth degree. But they've also captured the hearts and minds of a lot of people and made and brought them to be engaged. I think there has been certain mutations and the Reddit era and all that stuff. Again, COVID, I don't want to blame COVID. It's kind of old, but you know, COVID put all these trends on steroids. But as you know, right. COVID is around. Always think about perspective. Like mm-hmm. we are at the sunset of COVID. We could be sitting here in a year doing the same podcast and we wouldn't, and it would be like 1999. We wouldn't be talking about like it just a, it's a one time in history bump.
Yeah.
That just got on steroids. I wouldn't extrapolate that to being
right.
a long term.
The world.
And thing. So that's
by the way, I wish I had Robinhood when I was younger because I would have learned those hard lessons and then realized how futile day trading is for most people who don't do it professionally. And even then, and probably just said, okay, I'll go S&P 500 and invest a lot and see that return flourish. But instead, I had no on ramp and it was confusing. And I started investing too late.
Yeah. And I agree. And look at like look, right. in every cycle, I remember, you know, I'm old enough to remember in like 2001, like I remember like a cab driver in New York City who was trading stock on his like Palm Pilot.
Oh, like, wow.
It wasn't invented yet on the Palm Pilot.
Yeah.
And he was like, I'm making so much money. And then, you know, that's the end.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like, you know, when, and maybe there is a sense of it on the meme stock era so that, you know, that there's no, you know, when investments become irrational. And right. I think there's a element of it on the Robinhood users. And that's, you know, I'm not a big fan of it, but it's maybe the necessary evil that comes with the, you know, opening up investments and educating it to your point mm-hmm. to a younger generation. Like,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
Sorry. Why don't you finish that thought? And then I want to kick to a break.
No, I'm done with that thought.
Oh, okay.
This wasn't like, yeah,
good.
Let's take a break.
All right, great. So let's kick to a break now. And then we'll be back here with Dan Dolev right after this to get to why he thinks Coinbase is bad.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. In the last 100 years, we've seen financial markets swing, new currencies come and go, decades of savings lost in days, all showing that a retirement plan without a guarantee, quite simply, isn't enough. So more than a retirement plan, TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life, a promise that pays off. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
And we're back here on Big Technology Podcast with Dan Dolev, the Managing Director and Senior Analyst at Mizuho. You can watch a lot of his stuff on CNBC. Just go to YouTube now. Type in Dan Dolev. You'll see some interesting clips through the years. And Dan has really had a front row seat to this wild swing that fintech stocks have taken. So we'll get to that as soon as we go through the Coinbase stuff. But let's get to Coinbase. You have some reservations about Coinbase. It's a fascinating company. For many reasons, it's the leader in, you know, basically crypto. It's the leading crypto trading app and holding app in the world. It's also very public in terms of its political point of views. No politics in the office, which it made a big thing. I think their CEO, Brian Armstrong, is quite an interesting character. He doesn't care for journalists very much. They're very much into telling their own story, just like kind of a fascinating. They're an interesting product and also interesting political. Vehicle. But anyway, let's talk about the company itself, what it does, and why you're kind of skeptical about it.
Yeah, I'm very bearish on Coinbase and things. I don't know if having a front row seat in fintech was that much fun over the last year. But
You're
right about the.
It makes for a fun podcast episode, that's for sure.
It definitely if it gets you know people to enjoy our podcast, I'm all about
yeah.
it.
So
you
thanks.
Know,
Your
I just don't want to. I don't want to have that roller coaster again next
yeah,
year. Hopefully,
I believe
it gets a little quieter. But
right.
look, I mean, what is the whole promise of crypto? If you're bullish on crypto. Right. The promise of crypto or what crypto should generate or what should help is lower the cost of transactions between people between. So it's basically the promise is kind of like, if I want to send you money in El Salvador, why do I need to go through like a Remitly or one of these guys? If you're like, you know, a foreign worker you know, working out of the Philippines and sending money back to your family. One of the use cases of crypto is the ability to basically transact fiat to crypto, crypto to fiat, lowering the cost of acceptance, right? So if you think about the cost of acceptance, when you go to a merchant, it's like 3%, 4%, 5% sometimes with buy now, pay later. So if you can lower the cost of acceptance and do it on a cross-border basis, then you've really created value with crypto. You've really democratized. What is Coinbase doing? What Coinbase is doing is it's basically like a centralized exchange for a decentralized, you know, I would say asset class, if you want to call it that asset class. I don't really think you should call it asset class, but it's, so there's a juxtaposition even in the term of what they do, right? That crypto, if you believe in crypto, you should believe in decentralized crypto and in this. So what they're doing is basically they created casino is a hard word, is a tough word, but they basically created like a, you know, it's kind of like a, it's a gambling. Like, is this coin going to be better than that? And then the whole thing is they're not productive assets. So, you know, those alternative coins, and I would even say Bitcoin and Ethereum, they're just more of the same. So they're, but basically Coinbase does is they are bound to have diminishing. I mean, as a stock, I don't like it, right? They're bound. They've done very well for themselves, but the trading fees are on these things are going to close to zero, and there's no use case to all these alternative coins. So basically they're encouraging people to make, to make bets on these coins. And I think eventually that's going to end in tears. It already is ending in tears. So I don't I think from a moral perspective and also from a stock picking perspective, it's bad news.
Right. Yeah, they are an interesting company. We will have some more Coinbase questions to come. So there's Coinbase and there's also FTX. And there's this very colorful character, Sam Bankman-Fried. What's the difference between Coinbase and FTX? And why does FTX and Sam Bankman-Fried, I mean, there he's like considering an acquisition of Robinhood, although he said he's not. He's trying to work on some other stuff. Why is he and his exchange, you know, held in much higher regard at this point?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know FTX per se that well. It's a very good question. I don't know. They're bigger in Europe than in the US. I think that I talking about the acquisition, actually, it's like, you know, there has been news yesterday on Robinhood. I actually think that if they did it, it would be like peanut butter and jelly. Because what does FTX have? They have, you know, non-US presence, and they have a better balance sheet than most other guys. And what does Robinhood
have? And they have much less people than Coinbase. I think Coinbase has like 1,100, which just announced an 18% layoff. FTX has, I don't know, in the 300s from my understanding.
Correct. So they don't employ as many people. They run it in a much smarter way.
Yeah.
And I think they run it in a, you know, I don't think that, again, I don't know them very well. They're private, but I know, I mean, from what I understand is it's, at least they don't tell a story, a false story about this, the crypto economy. They call it like it is. But if you think about the Robinhood, just a word on the Robinhood FTX thing, I think it's really interesting kind of as a side note, because that peanut butter and jelly, right? FTX has the technology and the non-US users, and Robinhood has this amazing brand and can expand beyond. And even they understand that they need to expand beyond crypto. That's why they're going. But that's a different thing. So Coinbase is so controversial because you really think that no one really thinks that take rates are going to stay at one and change. They're going down.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I don't know why FTX is held in a higher regard. It's a very good question. It's a mystery to me too. I don't know the answer, and I don't know it very well because it's private.
Now, we're going to get to Coinbase's business in a second, but since we've been doing all the societal fund issues, in the beginning of this month, there was a petition where Coinbase employees wanted to remove their executives. Apparently, they had taken, you know, money, basically taken money off the table earlier. And there was this whole, I mean, it's very strange. We also saw SpaceX employees, right, to Elon Musk to tell him to stop tweeting. He fired them right away. And now we have this, you know, Coinbase rebellion, not a political one, but actually just saying that here it is from the Wall Street Journal. It was a petition to remove several top executives, including Chief Operating Officer Emil Choi, Chief Product Officer Saroj Chatterjee, and Chief People Officer LJ Brock. And it appeared on Mirror, and complained that the company's recent performance and demanded that the executives be removed. Hmm. I think Brian Armstrong said that this is really dumb on many levels. If you want to, this is so interesting. If you want to do a vote of no confidence, you should do it on me and not blame the execs. There is probably lots we can be doing better, but if you're at a place where you want to leak stuff externally, then it's time for you to go. You're hurting yourself and those around you. I mean, holy crap. For a company that outlaws, you know, discussion of political issues, they sure have a lot of drama. I guess if this is new to you, I'm just kind of curious. What's going on with the leadership there? I mean, and what causes an employee base to revolt in this way?
I think that they, you know, they did it. If you go back to their IPO process, right? It was a direct listing. So usually when companies go public, they go public to raise money. They didn't go public because they were at the height of the COVID, you know, mm-hmm. crypto mania mm-hmm. in June of last year, right? Exactly a year ago. They went public to a liquidity event to enrich themselves. And they mm-hmm. sold shares, and it's been very public how, you know, the mentions that have been bought, et cetera, right? So I feel like when it potentially, on the one hand, management is telling a certain story, but then on the other hand, they're, you know, selling shares, and it's so it feels like they're, I mean, again, I'm trying to think about what would cause that internally. And it definitely sounds like there is, there's a dissonance between, mm-hmm. you know, that what they're saying and then some of the behavior. And then the second thing is maybe they realize that, hey, our 85-90% of our revenues are at risk of going to zero if
right.
take rates go down to a few basis points, and all the other projects that we've done aren't taking off. Like NFT's not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. All these other staking and stuff revenues are kind of correlated with crypto.
Right. And not
it
to
doesn't
mention,
look good.
Yeah. And they only make money when people trade, from what I understand.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah, they make money on volatility.
Right. And people
they make
have
money
stopped
on volatility.
Trading. I mean, they've been selling, but.
This is actually a really interesting point. Can I mention something interesting?
Yeah,
so we've done a survey, Alex. We've done a survey recently that shows you this is, again, evidence based work that we do. Mm-hmm. The average cost basis for the average crypto or Bitcoin holder on Coinbase is $21,000, which means that the average Bitcoin investor on Coinbase, on the Coinbase platform, is now underwater.
What does the cost basis mean, and why does it mean that
it
they're
underwater?
It means
that the average person, so mm-hmm. we did a survey again, it's not
The average cost at which they bought their Bitcoin is $21,000. Is that
yes.
right? And
yes.
so now Bitcoin is lower
20
than
point
that.
Something. Yeah.
yeah.
So they're
20,000. So the average
Correct.
Coinbase user is down. What are the implications of that? That's fascinating.
That's exactly the point. That's exactly the
yeah.
point. So now we're dealing with a new era.
Uh-huh.
And this is interesting. This is the, I almost wanted to hire a casino psychologist to analyze it.
Right.
That would be a great, because now we're dealing with the realm of like psychiatry and psychology.
Right.
right? So now basically this is the first time in history, really, mm-hmm. that the average investor in crypto, called Bitcoin as sort of the beacon of crypto, has lost money.
Yeah.
Now they have to make a decision, fight or flight. Buy more? So we asked people, and this is really interesting. Again, take that with a grain of salt. But we've asked those same people, at what level are you going to sell or give up? Mm-hmm. It turns out that 50% of the people said this was actually like, I wonder what it would say today, but this was about a month and a half ago when Bitcoin was still at 30,000. Mm. 50% of the people, they said, I'm never selling. Mm. Again, at 30,000, life was good. They were up 50% on their Bitcoin. At 20,000, right. Life is bad. They're down.
And
they're not losing a lot of money. They're better than 2 weeks ago when it was at 17, but they're down. And the other 50%, it sounds like the tipping point. We call that research the tipping point, the Bitcoin tipping point, is about 9 or 10,000. So at that point, people will just run for the exit.
Because that means it goes to zero?
It means there's a run on the banks. That means that basically you've given up. But again, this is all it's not a, what about all the asterisks in the, is a non-scientific survey, but we did survey like 200 to 300 people-ish. It's a pretty good survey. And by the way, we did that same survey twice with a span of 6 to 8 months. And that $21,000 kind of yardstick keeps showing up as sort of that, consistently. So there is something about that $21,000 that's, there's a reason why Bitcoin's like hovering up and down that $21,000. It's really not just because it's a blackjack, but so I think there's something very interesting going on right now. There's a real debate in people's heads. Like, am I fighting it or am I flighting? It's a fight or flight at this point. Right. And I don't know. And I'm not a casino analyst, so I don't know. I just know one thing.
Most casinos, because the house always wins in the casinos and people still come back. So
the house is Coinbase right now. Mm-hmm. But the house is Coinbase, right? But the casino makes less money when 10 casinos open up on the same strip. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's happening with Coinbase. Back in the day, they were the only one.
Right.
And now Binance is lowering fees. FTX is getting more aggressive. So, Robinhood is already offering it for free. So even if this category remains, it's going to come at a much lower take rate. You're going to see the exact same mechanism that you saw with equities.
Yeah.
Whereas trading fees goes to zero. I would argue that because these are non-productive assets, 99% of them are going to go to zero, if not 100. Mm-hmm. So, I think that the outlook for, I make a big distinction between blockchain and crypto.
Yeah.
Different thing. They mix together, but I make a distinction between. I don't own any crypto. I have no intention of owning any crypto. Actually, I'm lying. I own $10 of Bitcoin. Now it's $5 because I was checking pricing on the Cash App to see when we were initiating. I was like, how much does it cost me to buy $5, $10? And then
$20,
I stopped.
Okay. So that makes sense. Yeah. And this is from that journal story that was actually in June about the employees writing to Coinbase.
Interesting. Yeah.
And so
I saw something where the CEO said, actually, when if you don't like it, you should quit.
Right. And that's
something else.
Well, he said that multiple times, but let's just read the numbers. So this was in June. Coinbase shares are down 77% so far this year and about 83% off their November record high of 357. On Friday, shares fell 7.9% to 58.71. And since then, shares have fallen even further because Coinbase is now at 51. Look, we know the NASDAQ and the S&P 500 are down, but fintech overall is just getting slaughtered. Why is the market taking all this out on fintech? What's going on? I mean, you watch these stocks all the time.
I think part of it, when you think about fintech, it's separate. Software is software,
right?
There's a SaaS, and it's sort of like it's much more, I'd say, unanimous. When you think about fintech, it's different verticals. Like the verdict for buy now pay later should not be the same verdict as crypto trading,
right? But people tend to group them.
They group them together. So now we're in this market dislocation. Yeah. I think that's going to settle itself out. Like you're going to see PayPal kind of going, PayPal has nothing to do with crypto. I mean, they'd like to tell people, or at least last year they were talking about it, but they really don't have anything to do with crypto.
So how difficult does that make your job? Because you're like trying to put price targets on these companies. So, here's one. You had Robinhood at a $68 price target last year, and it went up to 70, and now it's at 9. So,
Yeah, cool. That's called a bad call.
Yeah. Do you search your name on Twitter ever? Because it is a lot of people who are like, Dan's got to answer for these calls. So like, how did, yeah, tell me a little bit about
how really? You, no, man, I, thank God I'm not on Twitter.
Don't do it. Maybe don't do it. No, don't look. Don't look. So, but I'm curious, like what you think about it.
But send me the link. I'd like to see.
Yeah. Okay. I'll send it to you.
I don't know. Yeah. Send me the link. I mean.
I would lose. I'll be honest. If I was in my shoes trying to, you know, this market has just, you know, obviously shot up, you know, and then plunged down, and I would lose my mind trying to, like, you know, obviously someone like you reads the earnings reports, thinks about the market, mm-hmm. you know, thinks about the company and the market conditions, and then says, bam, like this should be 68. But like, again, I lose my mind trying to figure out what's going on in this market when we're seeing such volatility.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about sort of the way it should be done, and I'm not saying that this is the way people do this, but if you really kind of sit down, like let's call it the Warren Buffett way. Maybe that's too much, right? It's but the way it should be done, when looking at these fintechs, like the first thing you need to figure out is the sustainability of the revenue stream. So we have to like figure out the debate on, is this revenue stream protectable, right? Like we talked about the Cash App and instant deposits. I mean, I would want to think that it's sustainable, but I have concerns, right? Because there's, you know, this seems to be too good to be true, maybe, right? So how sustainable? And then you have to think about what is the terminal margin of these businesses. And then once you do that, like that's how hard our job is. Once you figure out this one and then that one, then you have to figure out what multiple you put on that.
Right.
And the multiple is the hardest thing to figure out. And I always liken it to measuring the distance in space. You're like, oh, well, the sun is XYZ miles from the moon, but it's closer than the distance to Mars. And like, so it's completely, you live in a world that has like, it's like basically like floating around in space, like the people at the International Space Station, you know, the International Space Station. Right. They're just like floating around, and they're like, you know, the water comes from above and it comes from below. There is sometimes nothing justifies what happened last year. And that's when we put these price targets because the multiples were very high and the correction is too deep. The answer is probably somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
Like last year, it's like, you know, real estate in Midtown Manhattan. There's some years where the market's hot and everyone pays up for that. And there's some years where the market's not hot and people don't pay as much for it. So our multiples vary with the marking to market because there's no other way we could do it. I can't control the market. The market is what it is, but I can control the sustainability of the revenue stream, which I still think is very strong for, say, Robinhood, and the terminal margins, which I think is very strong. So it's really, honestly, like our numbers have come down because they've guided down. But what's come down more than the numbers is the multiple, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. And it is interesting. Like when you adjust your price target, the market really listens to you, Dan. I mean, you see these stocks move. It's pretty wild.
Okay. Well, I did not know it, but I had no idea. I mean, look, I think it was a bad call on Robinhood. And I still think wholeheartedly, honestly,
yeah,
it's the most innovative name in payments alongside Square. And honestly, they have, you know, 2 feet on the ground, so to say, more than Square. I feel like Square lives in like a Bitcoin bubble right now. And I think Vlad and Biju, or whatever, can't pronounce his last name. The co-founders, they really know what they're doing. I really think that they are, you know, very, very focused, and it just sort of happened to be in when you go public at the height of an all-time cycle, like it's 1999, everything looks like a tough call.
Yeah.
It's hard. That's what I'm saying. Perspective, long term.
Yeah. Do you see any waters on the horizon, or are we going to be in the choppy stuff for a while?
Once you get clarity, I do see calm waters, and not because I'm staring at the Back Bay here in Boston and at the airport.
Yeah.
And it's very common outside. Here, let me show you.
Looks nice.
So it's beautiful. I do, once we get clarity on the depth of the recession and the duration of the recession.
So you're already calling it a recession.
I mean, I'm not a macroeconomist, but I think that's what the Fed is trying to throw us into.
Yes.
To lower. I mean, because the Fed has a very tough job right now. They were late to raise interest rates, and now they're basically fighting the inflation by raising interest rates.
Yeah, yeah. So, okay, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, so, but I'm saying, like, I'm not a macro, but it, I would say, yes, I think a recession is coming. If I had to kind of think about, like, you know, I think it's probably, I think that's what the Fed is, like, getting us into, right? And I agree that that's what they need to do to stop inflation, because there's nothing worse than inflation. Mm-hmm. Inflation is destructive. You know, go back to like Germany in the 1920s US in the 1970s. It's a disaster. You don't want that. So once we get that clarity, everything will calm down. And then people will start basically saying, okay, you know, it might not be the mania that we've seen in 2021, but again, it'll be somewhere in the middle. I actually think the second half at some point will have a nice rebound, and the volatility should abate as we get further out of COVID. Because remember, there was so much dislocation and everything we just talked about in the podcast.
Yeah.
It needs to be put behind us. It was a singularity in history that we won't see for another 100 years.
Right. And I'll just leave with this thought. I have a source in shipping who told me back in the day, the containers were 2,000. They had got to bring a container in from China. They used to be 2,000. They had gone up to 15 or 20,000. And he told me, Alex, inflation is coming. And inflation came. And now those 20,000 containers are now 8,000. So they're on the way down. So we could see supply chain easing. And we could see the Fed. Sorry. I'll let you have the last word.
Can I give you my insight?
Yes, please.
One of my kids' friends' dad, he's a genius. Mm. He imports canned food from China. A year ago, he was like, Dan, inflation's coming. Same thing, because he more persists. I saw him at like the baseball game. He's just like, his name is Dave. He's like really, you know, really smart. I saw him and he goes like, Dan, for the first time, I'm getting deals.
There we are.
Yeah.
So this is the beginning.
He called inflation and now he's calling. Why do you need Gary Gensler and Jay Powell? Yeah. Get Dave on CNBC.
Exactly. Just got to speak to your shipping bros. I mean, really, it's sort of been the core of this whole thing is the supply chain.
And I think that's why you're going to see the market. So you're already seeing like expectations for interest rates coming down in 2020, late 2023, 2024. And then you will see some calm waters coming, and then you'll see kind of quality rising, right? So there'll be I still believe Robinhood is an amazing asset, and I think Coinbase is not good.
Yeah. Dan Dolev, thank you so much for joining. What a pleasure speaking with you. Thanks for coming on.
Anytime. My pleasure.
Okay. That'll do it for us here on Big Technology Podcast. You can check out, basically go to tune in on CNBC any given day where there's fintech news, and you'll see Dan there. So I encourage you to do that. That's where we're going to wrap at this point. So appreciate Dan coming on. Appreciate you listening. We gave Nate a shout out at the beginning. Nate, you're a hero. Thank you, Nate Guatney, for editing the show, mastering the audio. Thank you, LinkedIn, for having me as part of your podcast network. What a blast it's been. And thanks to all of you, the listeners, for coming here week in, week out. We will be back next Wednesday with another episode with a tech insider or an outside agitator. Of course, please go to my LinkedIn page. We'll talk about it. We have a newsletter that's dedicated to the podcast there. So I'd like to see you there. And that'll do it for us here. So we will see you next time on Big Technology Podcast.